This episode contains graphic details of murder and other crimes. Listener discretion is advised. And welcome back to Not Always Polite. Before I get into anything, yes, I'm sick. I do sound like shit, so sorry in advance if you don't want to listen to this because of my voice. I totally understand. I don't have COVID, which is great, but I feel like I do, so not that it matters. But I do apologize for being gone for the last couple weeks. I was struggling with my mental health a little bit. Just needed to take some time for myself. Starting my new job has been a difficult transition for me from working from home. So yeah, your girl was just going through it. Anyone who struggles with their mental health probably understands. So I do apologize, but I'm back. Hopefully I can get back into uploading more consistently. As long as I don't get any more sick, we should be good to go. But yeah, today I have an unsolved case for you guys that I find quite interesting. Oh, our usual weather update. It was literally like 18 degrees on Tuesday, and today it's snowing. So no wonder I'm sick. This weather changing is bananas. I just burped, excuse me. I had a headache for 3 days. I was really going through it this week. I really have been going through it the last couple weeks. I think it was that weird moon. I don't know. I'm not an astrology girl. I wish I was, but that moon we had the other night definitely was doing something funky. Anyhow, let's get on into the case, shall we? In 1996, in Moffat, Ontario, which is a neighborhood near Milton, 42-year-old Wayne Griavette lived with his wife Diane and their 21-year-old son, Justin. Wayne was well-known in the packaging industry, selling bottled water from an artisan well on his property that he packaged himself. Before they lived in Moffat, Wayne and his family resided in Acton. Wayne, Diane, and their two children, Justin and Danielle, moved to Moffat 6 months prior, and their new location was only 30 minutes from their previous home. On December 12th of 1996, Wayne received a package delivered around 1 p.m. by Canada Post in his name. It contained a cardboard case of Domaine d'Or, which is a low-cost Ontario wine. The case's contents had been emptied and replaced with a Duracell floating lantern flashlight and a strange note that contained the names of people who Wayne knew, along with a, quote, business proposal and return address. Justin and Diane were both home at the time of the package's delivery. While Wayne was reading the weird note, Justin picked up the flashlight and attempted to turn it on. When that failed, Wayne started playing with it, trying to get it to work. That's when the flashlight exploded. Inside the flashlight were tightly packed plastic explosives and a blasting cap, surrounded by galvanized roofing nails acting as shrapnel and maximizing the bomb's damage. Justin was injured but managed to dial 911 and tell the operator, quote, there's a bomb and my dad just blew up. By the time emergency services arrived at the Griavette's house, there was little that they could do to save Wayne's life. He died almost instantly. So, that's a lot, but there's not a ton of information on this case, as usual. So, let's discuss the evidence. Keep in mind, this was 1996, so... Anyways, the package was wrapped in wrapping paper. It was white on the outside and hunter green on the inside. Inside the box was a box labeled Domaine d'Or or Cabernet. Sorry, Domaine d'Or Cabernet. Cabernet, good lord, which used to hold a bottle of red wine. At the top of the box was a rectangular hole that had neatly been cut off. Investigators suspected that this was to remove the barcode and UPC, which could use to be traced, trace the wine where it was purchased. Apart from the flashlight and the letter, which we'll get into, several flyers were used to pack the box. Most of these flyers were widely circulated in southern Ontario. However, one stood out. This flyer advertised Copeland Lumber, a building center located at 700 Main Street East in Milton, around a 20-kilometer drive from Moffitt. This was only distributed in the Milton area and was just that the mailer might be local to the area. Two strands of hair were also recovered from the debris. They did not have their roots attached, and as a result, no nuclear data Oh my god, guys, I'm so sorry. No nuclear DNA profile could be generated. The OPP enlisted the help of the FBI to generate a mitochondrial DNA profile, but this has not resulted in any progress. In a CBC podcast called Someone Knows Something, the postwoman's mother, who alongside her grandson were riding along as the postwoman did her rounds, said the package was delivered to the Gravett residence that day, and it had a very fancy ribbon on it, and it was not at all heavy, and the grandson was able to lift it. The flashlight used to house the bomb was a Duracell brand floating lantern flashlight. It was around 23 centimeters long and 15 centimeters tall. According to Justin, the flashlight might have been glued shut as he was unable to open the flashlight when he was trying to get it to work. A type of mining explosive emulsion called superfrack was used in the bomb. According to an investigator named Paul Johnson, around 1 to 1.5 pounds of superfrack was probably used. He also said that through theft, so you have to have a license to buy this stuff, so it was likely obtained through theft. The bomb was also packed with roofing nails to maximize the destructive effect and was powered by a single AA battery, which is kind of crazy. The letter included in the package was a business proposal, and it was written by one, quote, William J. French. In the letter, the writer mentioned that he and his partner were planning to start a new business called Acton Home Products in the new year, which was 1997, and that he would like a quote from Wayne on fixing some equipment. The writer was also mentioned that he had met and worked with Wayne in the past. The writer closed the letter by saying that he was looking forward to hearing back from Wayne, and I'll put the whole letter on the Instagram if you're interested in reading it. Two names mentioned in the letter, Lisa and Joe, were real people that Wayne knew. Lisa was Lisa Irvin, while Joe was Giuseppe Joe Zottish. Both worked with Wayne at Surge Beverage Equipment. Lisa worked as a secretary, while Joe did the delivery work. Their names had been redacted when the letter was first released to the public. Based on their analysis, investigators determined that the letter had been typed on a Smith's Corona electric typewriter. The letter was typed in all caps, and the font used was script 10/12. While the daisy wheel, which is a typing element of the typewriter, used was number 59543. I have no idea how they can tell that, but anyhow. There was an interesting anomaly in the letter that was observed by investigators, probably due to a bent arm in the daisy wheel. There was always a vertical slash after every period in the letter. Further analysis of the letter showed that some information had been faked. The letter had been written in a relaxed, friendly tone as if the writer knew Wayne personally. However, no one in the Gravett family knew a William J. French. There was also no business under the name Acton Home Product ever created. The supposed address listed used the wrong postal code, so it wasn't a real address. However, one thing was, quote, chillingly clear. The postscript of the letter indicated the writer knew exactly what was going to happen when Wayne switched on the flashlight. So postscript is like when they say P.S. So they said, P.S. I didn't realize you had moved. I had some trouble finding you. Have a very Merry Christmas, and may you never have to buy another flashlight. What the fuck? I think that's so spooky. So, now, as I mentioned, this crime is unsolved, but the police did have some suspects. Around November 1996, two men had come to the Acton Post Office and asked two different people about the Gravett's new address. The OPP produced a sketch of the two men and released it to the public, but neither one of the men were ever identified. Another person of interest to the investigation was Ed Galick. Ed was the owner of Surge Beverage Equipment, where Wayne used to work, and would leave Wayne to look after Surge whenever he went on vacations. Ed was also close with the family, so much so that the kids would call him Uncle Ed. However, according to Ed himself in Someone Knows Something, Wayne would treat the workers at Surge like dirt, leading some of the employees to quit. Also, at one point, Diane was working at Surge, but Ed thought she was not good enough for the business, and he had asked Wayne to fire Diane from Surge. Ed also claimed that Wayne started stealing money from him, something that Wayne denied, of course, and that he acted weird around him, which he thought resulted from Wayne using drugs. This, alongside other things, led Ed and Wayne to have a falling out about 3 years before the murder. Ed also said that Wayne's supposed stealing habit continued after he was fired from Surge, which might be the reason why he was targeted, and also that Ed's son, Ed Jr., whom he's estranged from, might be behind Wayne's death. So Ed here had a lot to say. He threw both Diane and Wayne under the bus, and his own fucking kid. So anyways, no arrests have ever been made in the case, and it is still unsolved. So if you have any information regarding the murder of Wayne Gravett, you can reach out to Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477. Or this article says to contact your local police service. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of crazy. I hope you guys enjoyed. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at NotAlwaysPolite. Leave me a review wherever you're listening, and I'll catch you guys next time. Bye.